We're going to open the subcommittee on Ways and Means of Human Resources this afternoon. And I apologize for not all of the members being here. I understand the House still may be in session, but because this is a day of public testimony, I thought we would get started so that we can accommodate all of the people that have signed up. And I'm sure that other Senate members will be coming very soon. So what I'd like to do is I may call you up in groups. When there are groups, I will, this sign-in sheet sometimes indicates that, so I'll try to call you up as this is together. And I would ask that each of you identify yourself for the record before you speak so that we know who you are and it can be on the record. And if you have written testimony that you've given to us, you don't necessarily need to read that into the record. You could kind of summarize what your written testimony says. And with that, we will get started, and I will call up Phyllis Lissman and John Mullen and Bill Wagner. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chairwoman Kutub, members of the committee. I am Phyllis Lissman, and I am from Burns, Oregon. I'm chair of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I want to thank you at this time for allowing me to testify today, and I would like to divide my testimony into two distinct parts. First, I want to spend just a few minutes reviewing the history of the Oregon models of long-term care. The second part, I want to talk a little bit about the critical pieces that we as a commission feel are missing from the governor's budget that you have before you. But first of all, let me thank you as a committee for the time and effort you spent in taking part in the tour of the various types of living situations in the long-term care system. And Senator Kutub, I want to thank you in particular for your leadership in arranging for that. We hope that this has put some faces and hopefully some smiles from doing this. I want to start off and give you, as I said, a very brief history of the Oregon model of long-term care. This started kind of way back when, as they say, in 1965, when what I like to think of is the foundation of the model that we have today in Oregon, when the Older Americans Act was passed by Congress. This led to the first programs being officially adopted and began providing services in 1967, when Oregon established what they called the State Program on Aging and the Office of Special Assistance for Programs. This began the long road that we've been down to be where we are today. In 1975, the second milestone took place when the Oregon legislature passed and created what we know as Oregon Project Independence, or OPI. This program was designed to help seniors remain independent by providing in-home services. And I'm going to be talking about this again just a little later. But the next milestone was in 1977. The Oregon legislature created what was called the Governor's Commission on Aging as an advisory body for what was then called the Office of Elderly Affairs. This office then combined the two offices that I spoke of previously. Another great milestone in our history was in 1981 when the Senate Bill 955 was passed by the legislature, creating Senior Services Division. The Commission on Aging's name then became the Commission on Senior Services, of which I chair. At this time, SSD was charged with creating a long-term service network that had some high values, those values being independence, dignity, privacy, and choice. Again, Oregon would be very proud as they became the first state in the country to combine the administrative functions of the Older Americans Act and the Title 19 Medicaid long-term care program. And today, I'm happy to say that thanks to people like you and the people out there in the field, the advocates and the hard worker staff, we still are a national leader in that field. It has been that program and the cost effectiveness of that program, as well as delivering the services, that has enabled SDSD to invest the savings realized from slowing the growth of nursing facilities to develop a number of community-based care options. This allows the divisions and its community partners to help identify people for the most appropriate level of care and meet some of those individual preferences. It also helps those who are not Medicaid eligible, the other seniors in the state of Oregon, who pay their own way by having developed several different options of care, in-home care, assisted living, foster care, those types of things. I sit here and I look at this history. It brings back memories for me. I started to work for seniors in 1972 in Harney County. I don't know how many of you know a lot about Harney County. We got lots of cows, lots of miles, and not many people. We're a long ways off. And I had the opportunity and the privilege, and I do call it that, to develop the program from the grassroots first day level. It was a real privilege. And I look back as I went through this history and prepared this testimony, and I think about those very first clients that we found in 1972 out there, and as we did an extensive outreach program. And I think back, and you know, when you live in Harney County, where it's very rural, you know your clients personally. You know them by their first name. You probably went to church with them on Sunday. You probably went to the 4th of July picnic with them. And I look back, and I think of what not only how much more cost-effective it would have been if we could have offered these services to those, but I think about the quality of life that they would have had the Oregon model been in place. So this was a real exciting time for me. The second part that I want to talk about is not quite so pleasant. Unfortunately, the Governor's Commission does not believe that the recommended budget provides enough resources, and I want to talk about three areas, just very briefly, because I know you'll be hearing about our bottom later on. It severely limits OPI, the General Assistance Program, by cutting the current service level. One thing I want to say just a little bit about, one of the things that it is cutting is a proposed cut in home service hours by 2.5%. Now, that don't sound like much, does it? 2.5% is not much. But if you are a frail elderly person or a person with disabilities and you're receiving minimum hours now, stop and think what that might do to you. It endangers your independence as well as it possibly could affect your health overall. We did a survey, the commission did, of the AAAs just recently. And I believe you have this in front of you. It's a one sheet of text, not attached to the testimony. We found some interesting things out there, which as a former service delivery person and as chair of the commission, certainly gave me some food for thought. As we looked at those AAAs throughout the state, we found that in all cases, those AAAs were limiting services to seniors in OPI. These limitations included waiting lists and limiting the number of hours of clients. We found that 56% of the AAAs had waiting lists in the last 12 months. 83% of the AAAs limited the number of hours clients would receive. The major reason they gave for this in the survey was lack of funding. I'm going to go back to Harney County for just a minute. We have, as I said, we're very rural. We don't have a lot of people. I did talk to our local case manager before I left home. She tells me we have roughly 40 clients in Harney County on OPI. And we have a waiting list, believe it or not. In rural Harney County, we have a waiting list. We deliver one service, Homemaker, assisted transportation. That's what we use our OPI funds for. There is a possibility and a need that we could deliver many other services, such as personal care, daycare, tours, respite, meals. These could be delivered if we had the money. And I think this is not untypical of the other AAAs, and they vary from place to place throughout the state. 53% of the AAAs said they would deliver transportation. I listened here on Monday and again yesterday to a program called the Jitney Transportation Program. Sounded like it might be an answer to some of those problems. As well, as you know, the commission is also supporting a transportation bill. And, you know, the first thing we have to do is get those people to the services available, whether it's a meal sign, shopping, doctor's appointments, whatever. That's the first thing. General assistance, we heard about that yesterday. We heard the figures. And there was one question asked up here. And I went home last night, and believe it or not, I woke up tonight and thought about this. General assistance, the last resort. Where do you go from here? You can't work. There's no income for various reasons. You're waiting on the federal government to make up its mind, and we all know what happens there from time to time. $298 a month. The question was asked yesterday, where do you live? You know, that's a really good question. I thought about that last night, and I thought about home. Where would I live? There's two senior disabled housing units. I happen to know both of them have a waiting list. I could afford to get in there, but how long am I going to have to wait? I don't know. I don't know, and I say this seriously, of any rooms to rent in Burns. I really don't. Apartments start at $450 a month plus utilities. I'm already in trouble. So I think that to cap this program, which is a last resort individual, would be a mistake. The other thing I want to talk about is something that I was involved with, and that's caregivers. Client employed providers. We are up to the point now where we're paying them up to $7.80 an hour. I know in Burns, they can walk down the street two blocks and get a job for that much. In fact, we have a motorhome factory. Their starting wage is 8.25. They offer health insurance, vacation, retirement, and a 5-day work week, 8 hours a day, and you go home. We need to professionalize our in-home caregivers. We need to be able to make them proud to be a caregiver out there in the field. How can we do it? There's been several options coming up that we had. Incentives. It takes a long time to train a caregiver. The emotional toll on the clients to change caregivers every 6 months. You don't need that. If we can offer them, you stay a year, you get another quarter an hour. You stay 2 years, you get another 25 cents an hour. This would help. The other thing, we need to offer training. Why not give them an incentive? You get another 25 cents an hour if you do certain training things to better yourself. We need to be offering these to these caregivers. We never want to forget that we're asking with low wages and no benefits for these people to take care of our grandmothers, our aunts, and our disabled people. And I think we need to remember this. The Governor's Commission strongly urges you to restore the funds for GA, OPI, and the in-home service hours. In addition, we would ask and urge you to provide funding for direct caregivers enhancements. In closing, I would like to say, before I ask the questions, remember that together we have built this program. You have been an important part of it. in the almost 25 years of service that I have had with seniors, 18 in the service arena, and 7 on the commission, I know I'm very proud to have been a part of the Oregon model, and I think you should be too. And I would simply say, in closing, you know, I thank God that I'm growing old in Oregon. I would like to field any questions you might have.
Madam Chair,
Senator Bryan.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for your years of service. You're a good advocate. Excuse my voice today. I'm losing it. In Bend, I practice law, and I have the privilege of being the attorney for the AAA there. You've listed 3 or 4 needs, from the transportation package to the provider wage to the governor's cuts. I was wondering if you could prioritize those for me. And I know that's difficult, but as we sit here in the Ways and Means, and if we can find a few dollars, we try to add them back.
Mm-hmm.
What would be your highest priority as far as the add?
That is indeed a difficult question. It's hard to put a priority on services, and I would hesitate to do so. I think the things we do need to remember is, number one is access. The first thing we've got to do if we're going to deliver services is what? Get those people to those services in many cases. This makes transportation a high priority. But yes, on the other hand, we have those frail older people, and those people are disabled, that without some type of help in the home or wherever, they have no life. And to be really honest with you, I don't think I can prioritize it. I'm sorry, Senator Bryant, but that's the way it is.
Well, if you're...
I'm not going to help you.
If you're a court of law, we declare you to be a difficult witness. But we won't do that. No.
Any other questions? Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Mullen. I'm the Director of Clackamas County Social Services. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. Very pleased to have this opportunity. Pleased also to follow Phyllis and the good work that she's done. She's been a colleague for years and an advocate, as you can see. One of the things that we're most proud of as far as talking about Oregon when we go to other states or we talk to colleagues that work in different arenas, even in this state, is talking about how we've developed a model here in the state of Oregon that is well worth preserving. Of the 18 area agencies on aging, you'll see that there's a map included in the packet there. We're providing an array of services all around the state that is as intended under federal law to be providing a continuum of service for those in greatest economic and social need. So the system works with senior and disabled services division providers, advocates, area agencies on aging, all working together to create this model. There are a number of things that are quite good in the governor's recommended budget, and we're very pleased to see them. But we also would like to state that we're concerned about the fact that the continuing service level in the governor's budget is not attained. And Phyllis talked about general assistance in Oregon Project Independence as examples of that. And in interest of time, I know that you have a lot of people that will be talking about a number of things. In fact, a number of people will mention some of the same things. And I want to highlight a few things that are in our packet and talk about them very briefly. One is about the client-employed providers, and specifically about Senate Bill 1114, which we're looking for a hearing over in general government. There are 14,000 or so client-employed providers around the state. Oftentimes, what's not thought about when we think about this model system is we think about it and talk about how wonderful it is, and it is. But really, the underpinnings of it and how it really functions on a day-to-day basis is really propped up by people that are actually not making very much money, don't have benefits, don't have protections for workers' comp and unemployment and so forth. We need to make some progress in this area. The legislature last session did a wonderful thing in helping to increase the wages paid to client-employed providers, and that's health. We think that there's a need for additional wage increases and to tie that over time to seniority and for people that have been around for a while, and to look in the areas of training where we can make some additional progress on retaining and recruiting people. One of the things that we have to get across to providers as best as we can as we recruit new people and retain them is the value of this program and why it's so important to have people who are dedicated and interested to be in this arena. And we do have a number of very dedicated providers, but as Phyllis mentioned, in places like Burns, in places like Oregon City, in Portland, people have many choices for employment these days, and so we're wanting to get the pay up and the training up, and also really to bring dignity into the system as much as possible and talk to everybody concerned about how important it is. I'm also next going to mention the Employment Initiative for Persons with Disabilities. This is in the governor's recommended budget. However, it's less than was originally proposed by the division. But I think that this is another good thing about the governor's recommended budget, and it gives us really the next step, one of the next steps that we need to make in this system. There's quite a bit of information in your packet that hopefully you get a chance to read. But I think back, when I think about this program, I think about a person in Clackamas County who I've known for many years. He's a client and an advocate and an entrepreneur. One of these days he's going to be a millionaire, I'm sure. He's very creative, very bright. But one day he got my attention by saying, he said, "You understand that if I am successful at what I'm trying to do here, I will lose my benefits. I'll lose my caretaker. I'll lose my health insurance, and what am I going to do in that set of circumstances?" And he pointed out to me, rightfully so, that everybody would be a winner if he was in the workforce and the benefits and services were still available. It would even work out for the taxpayer because those services would have been provided in any case, but now he would be a taxpayer and contributing to the system along with everybody else. So that's something that we hope that you'll take a very close look at when that hopefully comes down to you after referral from general government. The last thing that I'm going to mention is equity, and my colleague Bill Wagner is going to go into some detail about that, so I'll only say a few things about it in passing, and that is that when we created this system back in 1981, the legislature did a very wise thing in creating the system that gave us the model. And one of the important parts of that model was to give local government the opportunity to transfer people over into their employment and to create systems that brought the Older Americans Act, Oregon Project Independence, and long-term care programs. Now, back in those days, I was actually a provider and providing the Oregon Project Independence program, and the people down the street were providing the Medicaid program, and we didn't talk to each other, we didn't work with each other. This change has been really terrific in terms of bringing a number of services together to work for elderly and people with disabilities. The equity thing means that the equity issue really puts a lot of this, in a sense, at risk, because when we transfer these employees over in good faith, the deal, if you will, was that we would continue to receive the reimbursement necessary to keep the programs operating. So we, for people with their seniority, their sick leave, their vacation, the whole nine yards. And now in Clackamas County, to use us as an example, when we enter the new year, we will be funded, unless the legislature intervenes, at 83 cents on the dollar of what state offices get for the very same purposes. Now, it's interesting to note that SDSD, Senior Disabled Services Division, understands the problem, agrees with us, tried to get it into the governor's recommended budget, didn't happen. The Department of Human Resources also agrees with us, tried to get it into the budget, but it was turned aside. But also representatives here and elsewhere, the November Emergency Board, also agreed that there was a crisis situation and agreed to put money in for this biennium. So in your packet, there's Senate Bill 856 and 857, which we hope you will take a close look at, and hopefully 856, which has a dollar implication, will get a hearing down here, because I can tell you in all honesty that we're reaching a crisis, a breaking point in the system, and it really is something that is really more of a peculiarity of the funding formula, as Bill Wagner will talk about. We hope that you can do what you can to make sure that the system stays whole. And I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you very much.
Senator Bowen.
Two quick questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. the two bills you cited, have they been moving through the substantive committees? Have they had hearings, and or where are they?
Madam Chair, Senator Bryan, Senate Bill 857 has had a hearing. There's technical amendments that are needed that are of no real consequence, changes a couple of dates, and we expect that will move out of general government. Senate Bill 856 did pass out of general government, got a subsequent referral down to Ways and Means with a due pass.
And as you know, once they get that referral, they'll come down to I imagine, this committee for consideration. As I recall, Senator Cusub and I and Representative Ross serve on the e-board, and we put in $2 million to assist,
yeah.
And Senator Yee does also. Can you refresh my memory? I know that was to help in an emergency situation, but what exactly did that do?
Madam Chair, Senator Bryan, what that did is it prevented a crisis in the system. In other words, in Clackamas County, we were trying to figure out how we were going to get to the end of the year, and some of my colleagues around the state were in the same position. So what this did is it brought us equity, but for one biennium, or actually for 1 year. And so what we're needing to have happen so that the programs can continue in the way that they have and continue to be the model that they are, we need to have two things happen. We have to have the methodology corrected so that the problem that we had, so we don't wind up with 83 cents on the dollar in the future, doesn't happen again, and that $3.9 million of general fund are allocated to fix the problem for this next biennium.
So it's $3.9 million to fix, and you call it, I know it was interesting, over the equity issue.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Kutov and members of the committee, I'm Bill Wagner, Executive Director of Cascade West Council of Governments, which is the area agency on aging for Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln County. In your packet is a one-page description of the current positions of the area agencies on aging who are affected by Senate Bill 856 and a table that outlines the situation over the last three bienniums. Before I launch into a whole bunch of words, and you've already heard a lot about it, I'll just say that there's four words that are important to me. Partnership, wow, quirk, and no-brainer. So just remember those four words, and I'll keep going on. the partnership. Obviously, as you've heard, the senior services system and the services for younger disabled persons is a very big system involving state government, local government, and a lot of nonprofits. It's a big bunch of partnerships. The two big players in this are the state Senior and Disabled Services Division and the AAAs around the state. That's the big partnership that's at risk if we can't fix the problem that John has just talked about and that I'm talking about here that is fixed by SB 856. The wow is, it is a wow to the rest of the nation that we forged this kind of a very unique partnership where we've actually transferred the staff to do one important thing, and that's to make it easier for seniors and younger disabled to receive services in one shop. We have all the partners together. And just to illustrate it, it stuck in my mind. We've been doing this partnership since 1984. When the transfer was made and the case managers of the state for long-term care transferred to our agency, we saw an immediate 30% increase in home-delivered meals, simply because the right hand and the left hand suddenly belonged to the same body. So it was more efficient in terms of the seniors of receiving care, and it's been a very effective partnership. And that's the wow part of the system that wows every other state. I was just talking to some people from Texas Monday. Finally, we're getting our state that looks like lined up to try and do the same thing that Oregon is doing, and I know they've been working on it for a number of years. The quirk part is that the problem really is just a quirk. When the legislation was written, it contemplated that, of course, we'd go on with this partnership, but it didn't really look at the two things that have to be funded annually, and that's the cost of living as it goes up, and that is funded. And then the other thing is the fact that we all have personnel systems that have step increases, as the state does, and those step increases weren't taken into account. Simply a quirk here. And that's what's caused over time the disparity that caused us the problems that are shown on the chart. If you have that chart in front of you, you'll see that annually we've had a shortfall for, and I'll talk about my agency, 95-97 of $800,000. And then 97-99 looks like it gets better, but that's only because the e-board stepped in and helped us out. And then this next biennium that we're about to enter, that problem would jump to $1.2 million, which for us makes it impossible to continue that partnership. We have been putting in local money that we've generated through dues and other means to both shore up the system and to augment the services as a partnership should. And we will continue to do that. If you, again, are looking at the chart, you'll see the numbers that we've been talking about. We have a constant shortfall in the first two biennium that are shown there, but it's constant only because the e-board stepped in and helped with the problem last time. We would again like the resolution to that. In this chart, it shows a general fund addition of $3.8 million. Would satisfy the shortfall because it also generates additional federal money. I'd also like to point out that if the partnership doesn't survive, that local funding of $4.2 million really goes away because we're not partners, so we'd be spending our money over in our shops, and somehow that money would have to be made up too. And that's why this is kind of a no-brainer, I think. It isn't really asking for new money. It's just who's going to be spending the money that the system needs. And so whether the money is coming from the local government and through you to local government to make the system work, or you're operating it once again at the state, if all the transfer agencies had to transfer the staff back to the state, the same amount of money from the state would still be necessary. So I hope that these numbers aren't confusing and add a little clarity to our trouble. It's ironic that today we were meeting with the Rogue Valley Council of Governments who hasn't transferred yet, and you can transfer at any moment that you want to, even though the law was passed in 82. They would like to transfer, so they were talking about the benefits to us. At the same time, we were saying, okay, how does it work, and what are the problems that you have with system hasn't transferred, because I really believe that if this isn't fixed this time, we'll have to transfer the program back.
And I hadn't thought of that particular aspect, and I've certainly thought about this issue a lot. That government which would transfer today would be at a decided advantage over you.
Yes.
Because they would be transferring people from SDSD over to your AAAs at 100%.
That's exactly right.
They'd get a dollar for a dollar, where John, you were just indicating that since you did it years ago, you are getting 83 cents on the dollar. Maybe you should keep them back for a day, and then you could start tomorrow at 100%.
Senator Keith, the members and Senator Shields, I've proposed that to my AAA director, and he said, well, that would work for a moment, but the legislature would catch on to that. So that actually would fix it. And we only transferred the disabled piece of the program 2 years ago. So they aren't really, we don't have a problem with that piece. It's our senior services case management where the problem is from.
Other questions? Just a brief question.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for explaining what, although it may seem a no-brainer to you, is complicated to us. If the situation is corrected and you get the amount of money that would be equitable with other AAAs, what happens to the subsidies? Do the subsidies continue or do they go away?
Senator Kutub and Representative Ross, we would continue to subsidize the program. We may be able to use that money. We don't intend to take it out of senior services, but we may be able to use it for other things within the system. What we have done is have to use just about 100% of that money simply to match the Title 19, and we haven't been able to do other things that our seniors and younger disabled would like us to do with that money.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time, and I'll be following up on this particular piece. Thank you very much for this explanation. I would admit with Representative Ross, it's not much of a, you might think it's a no-brainer, but right now I'm looking at this and kind of, I have some questions, but we'll save that for another time.
I'm sure it's not a no-brainer, but I was trying to make it seem.
Right, okay. And Representative Wilson, I'm going to call him up. He probably has other duties and wanted to testify to this committee. So welcome, Representative.
Thank you. For the record, I am Carl Wilson, District 49 State Representative in Grants Pass, Cave Junction, and the southern two-thirds of Josephine County. I'm happy to be here to testify on House Bill 5029. I apologize to those who are waiting to testify, whom I've preempted here. I've got a red-hot bill I've got to get back to in my own committee, so I gave the hammer to somebody else separately. I want to speak on behalf of this bill and a couple of specific programs today. I want to assure the people who are looking at my backside here that I don't really do this for a living. Nobody in the legislature does this for a living. Really, I run radio stations. That's what I do for a living, and that allows me to be an intimate part of the community, and I've come to appreciate being a private business person, efficient programs, and programs that turn on a dime and make things happen. And so I want to talk about a couple in particular today. It has been my experience in my year and a half tenure in the legislature, providing constituent service all along the way, that senior and disabled services has been one of the most, really one of the most treasured people that we deal with, because we live in a community with a number of people who are aging and a number of people who have various infirmities, and we have been able to put those people together with this program, and I am just always impressed the way they react immediately and get something done. They're an agency that really has a heart, and my wife and I, in doing the constituent work, have really come to appreciate that. As most of you know, Senior and Disabled Services Division was created 18 years ago and charged with creating a long-term care service network that embodies the values that are very important to people, as you know, of independence and dignity and privacy and choice. And one of the ways that SDSD has sought to achieve these ends are by providing Oregonians with long-term care choices. And today, through the division's in-home services, seniors and people with such disabilities can receive services in their own homes. And I don't think that we can overestimate how important that is to people to have these services in their own homes or their apartments. These services, as you know, include help with personal or health care needs, and they can even include help with housekeeping. SDSD clients can choose their own caregivers, or the state can organize that for them. Nursing services, home-delivered meals can also be arranged for the elderly and disabled. As they should be, such care choices are available to all Oregonians through SDSD, and indeed the private sector has also benefited from the division's work. For as SDSD develops alternative care settings for its clients, it also provided alternatives for the public at large. And then subsequently, with Oregon currently licenses about 10,000 adult foster home beds, 60% of which are available to private pay clients. As all of us know, the healthcare sector continues to become increasingly consumer-oriented. Estimated that really 4 out of every 5 persons who need long-term care, public or private pay, will receive those services in community-based care. And already that trend seems apparent. Private pay customers prefer and choose community-based care over nursing facilities care. And as a result, the current occupancy rate in Oregon's nursing facilities is around 84%. As this system continues to mature, it continues to effectively evolve. Now the division, as you know, is focusing on the concept of aging in place and adapting services to the individual client as the person's needs change. Among great programs involved are Oregon Project Independence. There are so many different facets involved in this budget that you're looking at, but I do want to say from my own experience up to this point that these organizations have been so concerned about their clients, and I really appreciate that because, you know, as a state representative, I've been able to deal with a number of agencies over the last 18 months, and it is really interesting to me that as soon as I got into office by appointment, I think one of my very first appointments came with the people from SDSD. They wanted to get to know me. They wanted to know what I felt about the issues that they were related to. And of all agencies and all organizations, they have been the most fastidious in staying in touch with me and making sure that I know what is going on in all of their programs. So on a Josephine County and a community level, I just can't speak highly enough of the programs that are offered there, and would just really implore you to fund this budget fully.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We're going to call Rick Berger, Rita Bao, and Laura Fox. That's all right.
Yeah. You have Howard Deering on that one, I can tell.
Yes,
please.
Why don't we start with you?
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me come here and talk. My name is Rick Berger, and I am president of the Oregon Chapter of Americans Disabled for Attendance Programs Today, ADAPT. We are a national organization that fights for the rights of people with disabilities, in particular for the right to home-based attendant care. ADAPT's main concern is the continued access to community-based attendance services for all qualified individuals with disabilities. We are opposed to any cuts to the plan's employed provider program. In fact, we believe that home-based services need to be strengthened in order to maintain access. Due to the comparatively low wages and lack of benefits that clients employed providers receive, it is becoming harder to recruit and retain people to perform these important services. It is our position that the lack of providers will reach a crisis point within the next biennium. Currently, I am informed it takes an average of 55 days to fill a new order for a client-employed provider in Clackamas County. If you have an employee whose services are valuable to you, you try to keep his or her pay, benefits, and other working conditions at a level that will keep them in your employ. You don't want to lose them to another employer who might be offering higher wages. Clients in the client employed provider program, even though they're referred to as being employed by the clients, the clients may be able to hire and fire their own attendants but have no way to impact the working conditions of these valuable people. ADAPT believes that effective community-based care involves clients and providers working as partners to impact areas of mutual benefit. While we are proud of the efforts our state has made to promote community-based care, we believe that much more needs to be done to allow people with disabilities to continue to receive long-term care in home settings. To this end, we have endorsed legislation to create a quasi-public entity to act as employer of record for for client employed providers. Senate Bill 1169 will create an opportunity for client employed providers and clients to work together on these issues of mutual concern. It will also address the issue of workers' compensation that Representative Ross spoke of during this past Monday's hearing. I realize that some legislators and other interested parties have proposed turning the program over to private agencies as a solution to this problem. Because we believe that any care model must be consumer-driven, and I cannot take that more seriously, less seriously than I am, must be consumer-driven. That is unalterably opposed at both the national and local levels to any attempt to make our service better. To make our very lives a profit-making venture. A little over a year ago, I had the honor of going to Washington, D.C. to attend a congressional hearing on H.R. 2020, or the Medicaid Community Attendant Services Act, MECASA. This legislation was drafted by ADAPT and would do in all our states what we have done in Oregon. In fact, an ADAPT organizer from another state related to me that in discussions of this legislation with a state administrator from her own state, the administrator had explained that we were trying to Oregonize them. During this hearing, I had the honor of seeing former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Minority Leader Richard Gephardt testify together in favor of the legislation's passage. In fact, Speaker Gingrich pointed out that access to community services was one of the keys to getting people with disabilities actively employed. And as a result, the cost for services would be lessened and that we would be paying taxes and be contributing to the economy. I respectfully urge that you not cut but strengthen this program as our most important link to our freedom.
Thank you, Rick. Are there questions as well? If not, thank you very much, Rick. I'm not sure who is whom there, either Rita or Dolores.
Madam Chair, I present to the committee. I am advocating for Deschutes County, Jefferson, and Cook County. The local visa, Disability Senior Advisory Council.
And your name is?
Rita Law.
Thank you, Rita.
That's Mohammed. I'd like to call your attention to this quarter. We're all here because of this quarter, a lot of them, but of this quarter. We'll come back to it, I'll tell you what. I don't have a statement written, and I know I'm hard to understand, but please have patience with me. We need to discuss caregivers. They are an important part of everyday life for people with disabilities. As a consumer, I've had most of caregivers. Trust me, you don't get rich in this game. They have no benefits, long hours, and a little bit of pain. In my last year, they have come and gone, many of them. Maybe if I had was in a longevity, my son would not have committed suicide. Transportation is also a major importance in my life. You've heard over my last few days that our seniors and disabled have a choice of where they want to live. Yes, they have a choice. But in a broad area, it does no good to pick a place to live if there is no transportation to go shopping and your own doctor's appointment. That just scares your independence and it governs the way you live. Your constituents that are disabled and employable. The governor seems to want a generation of revenue if the individuals that are disabled are employed as they want to be. They become a taxpayer. Taxpayers will generate the revenue. Then the governor would not have to continually cut the CRC budget. When it's cut, it brings down the service level. And that may not mean much to you, but when you look at the person in the eyes, and the last few days, we have heard numbers, facilities, and seen graphs. But these people have faces and names. And when you look them in the eyes and say, oops, we don't have their service anymore, then you know SCSD needs more money. They do not need less. We have discussed OPI, the Oregon Project of Independence. That quarter says three words of civilized thought. It says virtue, liberty, and independence. We all know what it means, but I know what independence means. I'm just trying to. Yeah, I want to thank you for your time, and I'm sure y'all have any questions or comments.
Thank you, Rita. Are there any questions of Rita?
Questions?
Representative Logan.
Rita, thank you. I was wondering, do you have a person that helps you now at home?
Yeah, no, Rita. Unfortunately.
Yes.
I know, man, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that I require it. I would love to do for myself, but there are some things I have to have help with.
Surely. Further question. Has she been able to be with you for some time, or? How often?
It's different capacity. Yes. When I spoke of these things, they may not necessarily be my problem. But as never the local D-Shack, it's my job to advocate for people that cannot speak for themselves about Arnold Boyce's diet. Anyway, I did not explain how to do things, but when I first acquired my disability, I've been in the Army for over 9 years, so I had to learn how to be disabled, and that transportation for example, the interaction that it gave me, because it assured me that I could do the the interaction was imperative. I heard the whispers and I saw the expression and heard the little kids in the question. I experienced it, and there is no greater feeling when you are disabled. There's no idea in it.
Thank you.
Even with your personal care.
Thank you for being here and telling us about this. Thank you very much. And we'll go up to roll to Dolores.
Uh-huh. Yes. Thank you for letting me speak. My name is Dolores Cox. I was born in Ontario, Oregon, or Malheur County. Then my family, we lived across in Idaho, which is right across the Snake River Bridge in Fruitland, in the Black Canyon area, which was at that time being pioneers, and my father took the land out of sagebrush. And my father was an inventive man. He started things, was the first in many things, like he leveled the land a little bit to cool the hills down. He started the sprinkler system, which the first family to have a sprinkler system, and he actually built a barn to everybody's horror to just snuff the cows in. And then he decided that he heard in the paper about a milking parlor barn, which would take the milk into a bulk tank and a big truck would come and pick it up instead of carrying cans back and forth. And we were the first one to have one of these parlors, and everybody in the county would come around and look at it. And he also built a nice house for his family, which was unheard of. Also, when I was starting to walk, a neighbor who was a nurse, she said, told Mom and Dad, something is wrong with your child. You should go see a doctor. And he started trying to find out what was wrong with me. And when a businessman saw me, he told Dad about the Shriners. And he was a Shriner, and he said, why don't you apply at Portland or Salt Lake? There's two hospitals there, and they might be able to help her. Well, the Shriners in Salt Lake had an opening, and so that's where I started going. And I was the first child, I'm like my father, mover and shaker in the community, because I was the first baby they had ever seen that had scoliosis. And they had not seen, and they had to bring a doctor in from Denver who diagnosed my neurofibromatosis, which is tumors on their nerve endings. And when I was started to go to school, the school system said, you keep your child, handicapped child, home like everybody else in the valley. In the community, we don't need a handicapped child. She can't keep up. And my dad said, she will keep up. The Shriners told me, and my dad said, you show them. And I did. As the first handicapped child to go through the school system, which is now one of the top treating disabled children in the valley. And I went through college and got my degree in business. And I got out in the 70s, which meant that people and business and corporations. I went to some of the corporations in Boise. No one wanted a handicapped person in their business. But I could work in the processing plants. But then a friend of mine in college, the farmers were starting a daycare for their migrant workers. And she was the secretary there, and she kept pushing my application in front of them, and I got hired. I was the first teacher that got hired by the board. And some of the rules and regulations that I started are still in effect today. I worked as a teacher for 10 years, and then I got burnt out, so I started working part-time in a retail store that's a secondhand store. And there for 8 years, and then my back started to deteriorate, my backbone. And so I had to quit that, and I went to work at that time, Project Duff, which is working with abused women, started, and so they were opening up a shelter, and I became shelter manager. I did that for 2 years. And then I had to quit and become a volunteer because of my back. I've deteriorated 4 inches in my back. And the Dr. Stark shook his finger at me and said, "You have to go on disability. You cannot work anymore." And which is a hard blow for an independent person. I've never had to put my handicap first. And now I have to say I'm not handicapped anymore. I'm disabled. And I've had to further sell my house because I couldn't do the upkeep of it and move into an apartment with the help. Also, last year I had to have another wound to my independence, and thankful that I live in Ontario and I could do it. I have to have a housekeeper come in once a week and help with the upkeep of my housekeeping. I'm lucky that I live in Ontario because we have a pretty good bus system. And I don't know what would happen when I have to look at the day when I can't drive. And I'm lucky to have the house. I know I can have someone come in and keep my house clean so that I can get food from the food, have them bring in food at noon. I'm scared that I'll have to go into the nursing home if those services are not available for me. And which means giving up more on my independence. I appreciate you letting me talking to you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Dolores. Actually, I have a question of you. So the portion of this program that you have, is it Project Independent?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other thing I wanted to say is that I would not be at all ashamed of having somebody come clean my house every day. In fact, I hope and wish for that and have done it. So, are there other questions for this right now? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank
both of you for telling us your story. Next, we will have Sylvia Smith, Janelle Werder, and Janelle Werder.
Good afternoon.
Everyone.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sylvia Smith. I live in Southeast Perth. I appreciate the chance to tell the committee my story, almost as much as I appreciate the help that I've received from SDSD. I've been on SDSD for about 4 years. My disability is associated with fibromyalgia. I received SSI, food stamps, and medical care through Oregon Health Plan. I haven't always had a disability. For over 30 years, I was a beauty operator. supported myself. 7 years ago, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, making it impossible to work. In September of 97, I moved back to Portland from Seaside because there was not any job training and jobs were scarce in Seaside. I cannot stress the next statement enough. I received support and encouragement from my caseworkers at Southeast Portland Disability Service offices. My caseworkers intervened when I was having trouble getting needed medical services through my health plan. They connected me with an available training through Portland Community College, VRD, and One Stop. When the VRD program turned out to be leading me nowhere, I was most discouraged. Again, SDSD came to my rescue. A year ago last January, my caseworker told me about an opportunity, a Title V program with the USDA Forest Service. I have been in the program just a year. I'm absolutely thrilled with the program. I'm thrilled to be back working. Different problems that I've had over the last year, I always call my caseworkers, and even if it's just to talk to them, so get their opinion on things. Although the past year as a part-time trainee in financial management section of the Forest Service has had its ups and downs, my caseworker has continued her encouragement and support and continues to have faith in me. I have been asked to apply for a permanent position with the USDA Forest Service, and I'm absolutely thrilled. I know that I'm fortunate to live in one of the six areas of the state where SDSD has employment initiative pilot projects. I also know that there have to be many others all across the state who could be helped by this program. I have been told that this committee has the power to make this happen because you have the chance to expand the employment initiative all across the state. I'm asking you to do just that. It's a great investment in people, and it certainly has made a big difference in myself. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. So, any other questions? I'm glad that you were able to find that position as well. It makes a big difference.
Marvelous.
Okay, Janelle.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, committee members. My name is Janelle Werder, and I live in Salem. I've been disabled for the past 17 years due to a car accident. I've tried working off and on throughout the 17 years. I attended Chemeketa and received 2 degrees in social services and drug and alcohol treatment. I worked as an intern at Northwest Human Services and started out there as a student, went on to be a volunteer, and I'm now working in a position as a crisis intervention worker. I train new staff and volunteers. I work at least 16 hours a week, and I find that it's not only helping my community, but it has increased my abilities in many ways. Working supplements my income. It improves my self-esteem and self-worth. It gives me a sense of pride, and it affords me elements of independence, and it improves the quality of my life. The benefits to the community are that I'm a productive citizen. I'm paying taxes. I help others. I take an active role in my community. I feel I'm a positive role model for others. I've educated my peers and clients about handicapped issues. I provide Northwest Human Services with a dependable employee. My wish is to continue to work and to become financially independent. But until I am able to accomplish that, I will continue to need the support from disability services and providing my current level of services. I know several other disabled people who have the same desire to work, but need your continued support to make it happen. And I thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions have been asked? Again, we are pleased that you've been able to find a position, and so I hope that you also get the advance that you'd like to have.
Thank you.
Okay. The next group I'd like to call up is Ruth McEwen, Lucille Pugh, and Jan Campbell.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lucille Pugh. I'm a resident of Salem, and today I'm representing the Advocacy Coalition for Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'm co-chair of the statewide advocate organization. I'm sure that I'm feeling some of the same things that you are as a result of this recent testimony, and I would like to add that these are just a few of the stories that over the years I have been fortunate enough to hear and see and be a part of. I remember the first time that as a worker, and this was in Marion County and quite a long time ago, when an older person had to be admitted to a nursing home because of diminishing eyesight. She was unable to read her prescriptions and therefore unable to manage to live at home. And I vividly recall thinking there must be a better way. And I'm glad to say that over the years there are better ways, and that people really are no longer having to face this kind of choice simply because there are alternatives, and we have seen many people who've been able to sustain their independence and their sense of dignity and their choice. The coalition whom I'm representing today supports adequate funding for senior and disabled services division. I was a part of that group back in 1981 that was involved in the creation of Senate Bill 955. And this legislation really came about through the commitment of a group of seniors who felt that they were entitled to choice, independence, and dignity. And those principles are embodied in the legislation which the 1981 legislature authorized. Later, legislation was amended so that physically disabled adults who share these same values were able to be served through the division. It was fortunate that at the time the division was created, there was also the opportunity of securing a waiver so that Medicaid funds could be used for community-based in-home services as alternatives to nursing facility care. And I'll always remember the excitement that went with the creation of many kinds of resources. And one byproduct of this has been a tremendous savings in both state and federal tax dollars, and such savings continue today, even as the system becomes more refined. Another factor that I think we need to pay attention to is the fact that as the system became perfected, this has also permitted people who have private resources a choice as to the kind of services they want, where they want to receive them. And we have seen that many people who can afford to pay for their services are likewise choosing to have those things that will make them as independent as possible. The coalition believes that the spirit of the 1981 legislation has been carried out, and we hope that there is not a faltering now in providing significant support for the ever-expanding population of seniors and people with disabilities. It's critical that we continue to fund these programs. The coalition is asking the legislature to support an SDSD budget which continues the current service level. This includes both growth for caseload and inflation and for staffing, which realistically accommodates services to seniors and people with disabilities. We are opposed to three of the reductions in the budget which has been submitted. These include the no increase in Oregon Project Independence, the reduction in general assistance, and the reduction of 2.5% in in-home service hours. The written testimony, which you have before you, discusses these reductions a bit further, and they are pretty much the same as what you have heard in earlier testimony, so I will not repeat those. The coalition supports all efforts to continue to serve seniors and people with disabilities in the least restrictive settings, recognizing the values of independence, choice, and tax savings. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Sophia?
Phil, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate you're obviously a very knowledgeable person. Are you acquainted with the employment initiative that FDSC is working on to allow very disabled people to continue to receive their medical benefits while they're... What is your feeling about that project?
Well, I endorse it. I think we have seen for a very long time people who had talent, who had education, who have simply been held back from employment because of the penalty they would have to pay in not receiving either critical medical benefits or attendance services. And I think that this is an opening wedge where we will see a good number of people who will be able to sustain themselves, become taxpayers, but do need the assurance of these necessary medical care and attendance services, at least until they can get started, and perhaps some of them will need it permanently in some amount.
Well, thank you, Lucille, and they're very lucky to have you as an advocate. We appreciate your work.
Well, it's been a great experience.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jan Campbell, and I chair the Oregon Disabilities Commission.
That's who you are, Jan.
I've been a person with a disability for over 40 years. I started in a wooden wheelchair and was very, very dependent on my family. Through school and actually even through the college years. I've also have experienced discrimination when I was told in the early 1970s that I could not teach in the school district because of my disability, because it was so emotionally upsetting to people with disabilities, and have since been in the civil rights and human rights area for people with disabilities since then. And I am very independent, and I am seeing my friends who have become disabled have their independence, and I have seen both sides where I was very dependent. Now I'm quite independent, but because of having a disability for so long, I am getting weaker and will become dependent again. And I can't tell you how much we depend on Senior and Disabled Services Division and the partnership that we have with them and the services that they give to both seniors and people with disabilities. And I don't think you can realize it until you actually yourself experience some type of dependency. And they are the people that are helping, along with the people who are disabled and the seniors who are advocates, so that we can live just like you and be as independent as possible. So I would hope you would consider my remarks in considering the DHR budget, especially that of the Senior Disabled Services Division. The budget that is presented to you will continue the services of SDSD with two distinct clientele, seniors and persons with disabilities. This division offers services that are the envy of many states. In some states, the concept of these two populations peacefully coexisting in a single division is unimaginable. Advocates from both groups work cooperatively on shared projects. No other state can begin to match the feat performed within SDSD in Oregon. The Oregon Disability Commission, by statute, is SDSD's advisory body on disability issues. We take our role very seriously. The division relies on us and our services committee for advice and technical assistance, and we'll be hearing from the chair of the services committee in a few minutes. We are most proud of the work that SDSD has undertaken regarding the employment of persons with disabilities. The employment initiative began more than 2 years ago, which assists clients with disabilities to secure employment. With the initiative underway, SDSD amended the state Medicaid plan to allow persons with disabilities to go to work and maintain Medicaid benefits until their wages reach the threshold level at which their Medicaid benefits would cease. Oregon is the only state in the country to amend its Medicaid plan in this manner, as authorized by the Balanced Budget of Budget Act of 1997. These changes to the state's Medicaid program eliminate disincentives to employment for persons with disabilities. For persons with significant disabilities that require such services as attendant care, work is an option under Oregon's new program. Congress is considering legislation to implement much the same plan on a national basis, and Oregon is clearly the nation's leader in this endeavor. SDSD has been leading the way for Oregon. We would also like you to call upon you to approve the funding for the Employment Initiative Policy Package. With this funding, SDSD, in partnership with its sister divisions at DHR, will move forward with its plan for assisting persons with disabilities to secure and maintain employment, thereby helping them to become taxpayers rather than consumers of tax dollars. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
I just have a question for Ms. Pugh. Are you the same Lucille Pugh that used to work for the state years ago? That I used to come and browbeat to give more money to Home for the Aged?
I didn't take it as browbeating.
Many is the time I have tried to encourage this great lady to help us out, and I'm glad it took a long time to get on our side.
Get on your side.
Incidentally, Lucille, you remind me very much of my grandmother. Of course, she would have been your age when I'm thinking of her, and you remind me of her.
I'm only 21.
I know. But I mean, it's, you know, I mean, in the past, right?
I put on your head.
Yeah, okay. Great.
Chair, Senator Cusack and committee members, my name is Ruth McEwen. I live here in Salem. I'm wearing two hats today. I'm here as the co-chair of the Medicaid Long-Term Care Quality and Reimbursement Advisory Council, and I have submitted some written testimony from them. And then my other hat is that I am the chair of the Oregon Association of Disability Services Advisory Councils. I'm mostly speaking from their point of view. We believe that the cuts will affect the mission of the Senior and Disabled Services, in that it will remove choice, independence, and dignity from the people that are seeking it the most. The 2.5% cut in service hours may mean the choice of living arrangements will be completely compromised. There'll be less hours of care, which may force somebody into a different setting to get the care that they need. There'll be less hours that the providers may work. And so this will mean that many of the providers will need to find other employment, which will cause a problem in finding new providers. And this lack of providers will also affect how people will be able to get to school, find work, become the taxpayers, and to have that choice that they want to as to where they live. And it also can lead to a very high cost care setting. So we ask that you would look at the client employed providers. And others will be testifying in more detail, which you've already heard before, how important this affects their personal lives. And there will still be others. And therefore, we believe that the senior civil service budget would not be a means of saving for the state, but a means of increasing the cost of mandated care if the 2.5% cuts were there. It would take away from the mission, and it would not provide services in the least restrictive environment. And the Medicaid Long-Term Care Quality and Reimbursement Council is also concerned that the reductions that are being proposed would not allow people the right of choice, independence, and dignity.
Thank you. Other questions? If not, thank you all for your testimony. We'll go to the next panel, which will include Alice Neely, Mike, hello? Hello, Pete? Okay. Volpe, I'm sorry, and Lori Sitton.
So why did he cut it? Why did he cut the
Good afternoon. Chairman Sussab and members of the committee, my name is Alice Neely and I'm from Milwaukee. I'm Clackamas County. And I'm chair of the Clackamas County Area Agency on Aging's Advisory Committee. I also chair the State Association of Senior Advisory Council Chairs. And I'm speaking on their behalf today. I'm also a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, wear another hat and speak for the same things. I'd like to explain why I think this committee should fully fund the Senior and Disabled Service Division's budget and increase funding for caregivers. You've heard lots of talk. I've been attending these hearings throughout, and I know that you've asked questions and understand the plight of the client-employed provider. It's just as someone said today, a crisis. It's just a crisis point. There are friends. In fact, there's one here who chairs our disability advisory committee in Clackamas County, who had a care provider for 6 years, and they were close, and she did everything, but she could no longer afford to stay on after 6 years. This person needs a lot of care. And she has another one now, and she's lucky, who is going to work out just fine. There's a member of the staff in senior services in Clackamas County who is very disabled, who has a very difficult time in retaining a care provider. She needs a great deal of care, more intensive care than my other friend, and they just don't stay long enough. And she tries to train them in her needs, and then they're gone again. As a matter of fact, she fell out of her bed just a short time ago because she wasn't getting adequate care and broke her leg for I don't know how many times it's been done. And she's very disabled. So that's because they're not paid enough. And even this minuscule raise that's being asked for, as someone used a quarter example, and that's all it is a quarter. I think it comes all together to about $6 million. It's a 25% increase now and then 25 cents in 6 months and then I think 25 cents after 2 years. And that's just a very little bit of money. And it would do so much good. It would stabilize the workforce. It would reduce turnover and it would ensure better care for clients. And the other thing, one of you mentioned, I think Monday, was the lack of benefits. And I think someone asked how they could work without, and they have none. And they don't get any workman's compensation. And there is lots of back injuries that happen in this business. So it's a physically heavy work. I can't tell you how much the need is for more money for these people to keep them. Also, I think on Monday, you asked Senator Qtob if there were any kind of an association. Well, there was an attempt made last biennium to unionize these people, and nothing happened. And there is another attempt going on now, and I think that it might succeed, maybe not this time, but the next time they go out that it will, and that will mean much more money probably. And they are very vital. It's a very vital need in our long-term care program. And I'm also very concerned about the proposed cuts to Oregon Project Independence. This is, as been said, the money for the people who fall in the cracks. They can't get Medicaid. They can't get Oregon on the Oregon Health Plan. And this little bit of money, and it is minimal in the overall budget, helps these people keep their independence and stay in their home. And with cuts to this service, they might get one less bath a week. If you only get one a week, you're not going to want to come see them when they can't bathe themselves. But it's the little things like that are going to be cut. I mean, we think of it as a little thing, but it isn't if you're absolutely homebound and have no way of bathing yourself or whatever. So I'd like to ask you to support this Senate Bill 1114 that would provide the pay increases for direct caregivers while providing opportunities for training. And hopefully the next biennium we can come forth with a plan for some benefits for these people. And I represent a lot of seniors, and I can't tell you how wonderful the advisory, very agency on aging advisory committees are in this state. They're the most enthusiastic group of people, and the work they do, the work they accomplish is unbelievable. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
Representative Logan.
I want to ask Alice how many times you have come forward to advocate. I think
I've been doing it for 14 years.
I know it was long before that.
Well, I always circle in on her. That's where I am.
And she puts in more hours at our senior center than anyone, like volunteering full-time.
Thank you, Jim.
And more.
Thank you.
Alice, the question that I asked, I think I asked both questions.
Did you?
The other day about benefits and association. I wasn't, however, meaning unionizing when I said association.
I didn't think you were, but that went in my mind.
Yeah. I was actually thinking of some entrepreneur or somebody who wanted to create an association whereby they would have an umbrella
mm-hmm.
to be able to provide for them health insurance and several other things. I was a small business owner that at one point in time, these individuals were, in a sense, self-employed and leasing a spot from me. And there are ways of doing that as well. And if there is a need, it would seem to me that somebody should, just be work smart and try to join these folks together to be able to get some health insurance and things for them.
I agree with you, and I realize what you meant, but I also know there's a threat of unionization in the state. And one of the things is you have to be very dedicated to do this.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it at any time. But on the other hand, they often get people who are don't care. And only stay long enough to get a roof over their head or something for a week or so, and then they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a constant turnover. There's no reason why they should stay in the business.
Right. And I understand that problem. Mm-hmm. Very evident to me throughout this session and these hearings that there is a real need, and we need to
do
what we can.
I know.
To try to.
And I know you will. I just hope, because every cut is not just a dollar figure, it's a person and their needs. So thank you.
Thank you, Alice.
You're welcome.
Lori.
If I may, can I defer to Mike?
Sure. Mike, sure.
Okay. My name is Mike Volpe, Senator Q-Tupin Community. I live in Albany, and I am the chair of the Oregon Cascades West Council of Governments Disability Services Advisory Council in Lynn Benton and Lincoln County. Say that fast, pretend. But I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis 21 years ago, and so I have experienced a number of stages of the disability. When I was first diagnosed, I could run, I could do most anything that any other 23-year-old could do. And now I am a virtual quadriplegic, meaning that I have no strength in my arms or my legs. 5.5 years ago, I started to depend on overnight caregivers because I couldn't do the necessary activities of daily living, such as getting in and out of bed, taking showers, dressing, things of that sort. And that's really, I was ill and in a nursing home, and to recover, I came out of the nursing home. Before I was in the nursing home, I was able to take care of myself. Once I got out of the nursing home, I was not able to take care of myself. That night, I had an overnight caregiver. That's a heck of a learning curve, because all of a sudden, overnight, I was the employer of a person who basically had everything over me. I mean, I was totally helpless, but I was the employer of that person. And I had no training in being the employer of that person. And as a result, I made a lot of errors. And that was part of the reason why I went through quite a number of caregivers when I first started out. However, in the ensuing, say, 3 to 4 years, I have learned a lot about being the employer of several people who are caregivers for me. And I have improved my technique or whatever, because I think every employer has to be able to speak with their employees in a fashion that make them want to come back and work the next day. But also, I am still having some difficulty with turnover. November 1st, I believe it was, a woman that had been with me for quite some time left, and since then, November 1st of 98, since then I have had 10 overnight caregivers. Some of them have lasted for 2 or 3 weeks. Some of them have lasted, they quit during the training because they decided they couldn't do it. I weigh about 170 pounds. I'm a full assist transfer. I'm quite a load. And someone has to be, fairly decent and in their transfer technique in order to pull this off. Also, I do have a number of other skin conditions that kind of ensue from somebody being in a wheelchair all the time. And so another additional talent for caregivers is that good observation skills. Because as you all know, a little bit of prevention is worth a whole lot of cure. And if I have observant caregivers, basically they can take care of situations before they become problems. One thing I would like to point out to you is that Oregon is extremely fortunate to have the waiver situation, which a number of other people have talked about. In the handouts that I had, there are two pages of pie charts. And the waiver occurred in 1981. The first pie chart shows what the percentage of people in nursing homes and the percentage of people in who had home care in 1985-86. And the second pie chart shows it in 1996-97. The number of people in that have in-home care almost doubles. The number of people in nursing homes is cut in half. And this, I think, indicates that people would rather live at home, which doesn't really take, I mean, some power, I'll figure that out fairly easily. But I think that this chart does help to prove it. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, and the second page of charts basically shows the cost of the different forms of care for people with disabilities and seniors. And this also shows that in-home care is one of the more economical ways to take care of people. And the number of people the percentage of people that are cared for in the home is much less than the percentage of the budget that is used to care for these people. I'd like to close by just saying that there really isn't a way that I can put a dollar value on what it means to me to be able to live in my own home. Obviously, I have a very serious disability, and without in-home care, there would be no way for me to live in my own home. I can think of three things right off. My own independence, which is extremely important to me, and being able to make a contribution to society. I am not currently working, however, I am volunteering. And the third one is that I was able to get married 3.5 years ago, and that more than likely would not have been able to occur had I not been living in my own home. Thank you very much for your time. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mike. I think what we're going to do is move to Lori next, and we have an entire page of witnesses to still come forward in 6 minutes.
No question.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Sitton. I am also a consumer of services with Senior Disabled Services Division and long-term care about 17 years now. I, as Dan Campbell mentioned, that from the Services Committee or the Disabilities Commission Services Committee, I do chair that. I would like to echo some of the things that have been mentioned today, but be more specific to client employed providers. Again, they are a very integral part of the system. They help people in the home to live more independently, have more choice in their lives. I would say that Oregon really, I
I am traveling about the state and working with other people with disabilities. Oregon is, what are they doing out there? They're doing something that's working, that's helping people with disabilities live independently. Nursing home is not the only option. When I first became injured in 82, the buzz about the family and friends was a nursing home. All the thought of living in a nursing home and the images that got portrayed was very discouraging. And come to find out, no, there were a lot of different options that were possible in Oregon. And I've been able to experience 3 or 4 different settings of living in an apartment with a full-time living attendant, living supportive housing, adult foster homes. What I think is unique with Oregon is that there's such a continuum that as an individual's needs change, the system is also flexible to be able to meet that need. And the client employed provider program is one that really can address this sort of thing, but the providers are not compensated enough. I think that, and I'm not alone in this, certainly, but it's not just compensation in terms of dollars, but also the respect and other aspects of employee and career options and training. Training is a big piece that is important to the program as well, because I think that the provider of care, given proper training, will be able to, as Mike spoke to, look at skin condition and other things that would be, if noted early on, as you said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Also, their own safety and doing transfers. That type of job is very demanding physically on the provider. With proper training, they can care for themselves as well as the individual. We really need them. The system is growing. It changes, it evolves. We need to spend more time and effort in the client employed provider program to be able to attract providers and meet the coming demand in the future. Oregon is doing some wonderful things. I really urge the committee to support their budget and help us live more independently in the community, seniors and people with disabilities, and be contributing members of society. The client employed providers are very important for people with disabilities as well to help us go to work, get up in the morning, get dressed, go shopping, and do all the other things that non-disabled people are able to do as well. And we have 4 minutes for a page of people. Okay.
Thank you very much, Maureen. Thank you all for your testimony today. Okay. Laura Woodruff, Multnomah Academy. Liz McKinney and Anna Zadilova.
Good thinking, Tim.
Again, I might say, identify yourself for the record, and if we've already discussed an area, you might just say that particular area you want to reiterate, but that way we can try to get as many as possible.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Laura Woodruff. And I feel very lucky because as a child growing up in Portland and Long Beach, Washington, I was given the best of everything. My parents made sure that all of my needs and wants were met. In August of 1972, I left La Grande, Oregon, and my college career behind me when I embarked on a new journey in my life. I was 20 years old and ready to take on the world. For the next couple of years, I traveled around the U.S. and Canada, enjoying myself and not having a care in the world. In May of 1974, I began my working career with a commercial laundry in Northwest Portland while I pursued my love of music as a professional musician. In September of 1988, I had over 50 private piano students proceeds for the music reading texts and workbooks for children that I had written, and was working as a musician every Thursday through Sunday night. I took home an average of $2,700 a month. I worked hard, made something of myself, bought a house, a new car every year, took lots of vacations, and was enjoying life. In December of 88, I started looking for a new home to buy. I was going to be a landlord, having paid off my house in under 10 years, and I figured I could buy another one, rent out the little house, and pay off the mortgage even faster with rent and with my payments. But on December 23rd, 1988, when I was to sign the closing papers, things started changing quickly, because on December 22nd at 8:30 in the morning, while I was at work, I broke my back. To make a long story short, I've not had a job that would support any lifestyle near to the lifestyle that I had prior to that. And now I even have to attempt to clean my own house. And the hardest part of that is that I no longer have the stamina to do it. I now live on a $674 a month pension from Social Security Disability. I had good insurance at the time of my accident, but presently I have no dental, no vision, and worst of all, no prescription coverage. I have about $200 worth of prescriptions to purchase each month, and that doesn't leave me with a lot of money to live my extravagant lifestyle. The lifestyle gone long ago left me still living in my little house now for over 20 years, and this is very frustrating. I want so many things out of life that I know I will never have, but my wants are trivial to the wants of some of Oregon's most needy people. I'm talking about the people that cannot make decisions for themselves and need the help of those of us that want to help them. I'm talking about the people that need someone to help them get dressed in the morning and undressed at night. I'm talking about the people that cannot speak or get themselves to the toilet or take a drink of water by themselves. These are the people being served by SDSC. These are the people that I am here to represent. I'm an advocate for the disabled. I am an advocate by choice. No one makes me do this. No one twisted my arm and forced me to come here today. Instead, I am here because there's a need to be heard. I've met many wonderful people that I am now proud to call my friends since becoming disabled. The adjustment was hard for me. I have to keep reminding myself every day that it could be anyone in this room that could become the next disabled person. Yesterday, as we left this very building, one of our advocates fell on the front steps. And as I wrote this at 12:30 this morning, I didn't know how Alice was. I'm happy to report that she is here and fine today. But she could have been the next person in need of services from SDSC. None of us knows for sure. I'm going to be all right. This month is my 20th anniversary of teaching private piano lessons. 20 years. It's a long time. I may not have prescription coverage now, and I may not always have a bank account with enough money in it to pay for my prescriptions, but I'll cross that bridge when the time comes. It's simple. Sell my house, all my belongings, go on a tremendous vacation, come back to Oregon, live in public housing, get food stamps, be put on the Oregon Health Plan, and sit around the rest of my life doing nothing. I'm very lucky that, well, all kidding aside, I'm very lucky that when my father died 4 years ago, he left enough money and assets for my mother and my brother and myself that none of us will ever need services. But what about the people that didn't have someone to leave them money or send them on vacations? What will they do? Who will they depend on? Hopefully it can be the state of Oregon and SDSC. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Anna?
Я Саша, вам все объяснить не могу свое положение. Разрешите моей переводчице вам все рассказать, мое, что я хочу вам сказать.
The lady speaks Russian. Her name is Anna Zavialova, and I'm translator for her. My name is Elena Seisman. I'm from resident of Gresham, Oregon. And she's an old lady. She has a written statement. Of course, it's on Russian. She doesn't speak any English, so forgive for that. And she would like to meet to read for her what she has written.
Okay.
She's 87 years old. She's a Russian lady. 6 years ago, she immigrated from Russia to America. Her status was a parolee, so she wasn't quite the enough evidence to become a refugee to this country. What does it mean to her that she wasn't able to apply for assistance?
First, she got her food stamps. Now she cut off even from food stamps because of sundry law change that she could not have a food stamp because she is not a refugee and she is not a citizen. She got her she is not getting SSI because, of course, two of these things that she is not making eligible for SSI. She has to be blind, mentally ill, and her age, of course, is not counted for SSI. So she's kind of fighting against SSI to become one of the persons who could get a benefit. She has an Oregon health plan, but again, she has a daughter who's become care provider for her because of her age, she's not able to do the things that the people could do for themselves. And today, while she's here, she just wants to tell how much needed for her to have a service as DSD, because she's one of the clients of the service, and she doesn't know what she could do if the service would be here to help her, because she has zero income at all, and for 6 years to become in this country, she could not have any income. She did not work here. She has no one who could support her. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the Ways and Means Committee, I'm Liz McKinney. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Trail Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, here today representing a coalition of all the chapters of the Alzheimer's Association in this state. My written testimony is brief, and in the interest of time, and in another life I was an editor, I will be even briefer and kind of paraphrase for you, and simply endorse all the appeals that you've heard today. The Oregon chapters of the Alzheimer's Association strongly urge you to support a continuing level budget for the Department of Human Resources and for the Human Disabled Services Division in particular. More than 62,000 Oregonians are affected by Alzheimer's disease. And by extrapolation and by both review with SDSD staff, we believe that 60% of the residents of Oregon's long-term care system, be that the community-based care system or the nursing home system, are affected by Alzheimer's disease or one of the related dementias which are part of our name. To cut the services that provide care for this very vulnerable population, which is not often able to advocate for itself, will cause significant harm to this population. So on behalf of the Oregon Chapters of the Alzheimer's Association, I strongly urge you to support the continuing level SDSD budget. And I'll be very glad to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for all of you for coming forward. Okay. Adele Kissel, Lori Freeman, and Carl Schegelman. And thank you, committee, for staying. We appreciate you. Doing this because you're hearing this.
Three more.
Three more after that.
Three more. Another ten.
Okay, thank you.
Young little boy in his care of the post. The after was slow, that's the Sopana brother. The girl is the Sopana, the Sopana, the Berila, the youngest came there.
Yes, he's thankful for letting him speak today. His name is Kessel Adol. He's a Russian immigrant 2 years ago from a former Soviet Union. And he one of the clients not yet. He applied for PEP program for some assistance. He came as a parolee. He has no income and it's really hard for him to survive in this country. He has no language. Of the age 62, none of the employers could hire him at this age. He has a major back disability back from Russia. He wasn't working
for the last 15 years. But of course, to prove that here in America, it takes so much time with the SSI to improve that he's eligible for SSI benefits. And he's a really independent person, was back in Russia before his injury. And right now, he's a dependent person when he needs someone to take him care of, to do the thing that he was able to do. And he briefly with the time. He's really supporting the program that's going to be no cost of that program because he needs assistance with that program.
Okay. Thank you very much. No questions? Are you Carl?
Yep.
Okay, Carl.
Yes,
sir.
You mean we're not going to call it quits at 3 o'clock?
It's 10 minutes after, so we haven't done it yet.
So are there very many more, so I should just keep it brief or what?
Yes, please do.
Okay.
We've got one more panel after this panel has been completed.
Anyway, I thank you very much for hearing those of us speaking, Fulton and myself right now. I'm a newcomer to Oregon. Just been here about 4 months, okay? And I come from Florida. Right now I live in Linn County. And in this 4 months I've had a little peek at what's happening here. But before I say anything else, I've got a little background in aging services. I've worked for the state government of North Carolina in aging services for 11 years. And I've been involved since I retired in part-time activities, volunteering with Area Agency on Aging and services for those that have health insurance. So I have some grasp of the field. One of the things that have been obvious to me, I worked with the senior center we have in Lebanon, and I worked with the Area Agency on Aging, Cascades Council of Governments. So from the senior center by itself, one of the things they did try to get the voters to vote for a complex for a senior center and a new library. Well, this was voted down. So this is a great need. Hi, Senator Yee. I'm in her district. I don't mean to neglect the rest of you, okay? But I've written her a couple letters and she's responded to me too. But one of the problems there, too, is a matter of operating costs. It's a city senior center, okay? This happens many places, I know from my experience in the past. And in some places, like the county runs the senior centers, you know. And they suffer because of operating costs, and that's a problem. One of the problems I know they have is we have a dial-a-bus system, thank God, which does provide some services to get people around. But again, here, if I lived outside of the city of Lebanon, a couple of miles, they won't come up and pick me up, you know? So this is one of the real problems. So as a result of that, too, I went to Transportation Lobby Day, which you had, some of you know about, which they had, a month ago with it or so? And I went there with the Area Agency on Aging Director, and we had a chance to hear the testimony there and had a chance to meet briefly with Representative Prof at that day, who was representative for our area. In this transportation area, I found a letter to the editor of one of our local papers, let's enhance, not cut transportation for seniors. Well, this is the cry of other people too, okay? Just from looking at this booklet here, I don't know whether everybody has this kind of a booklet here, there's some things that are very obvious in here from looking at it. When you look at it, say that 44% of the elderly have incomes below poverty, and 68% of those elderly are female, you know, so just tells you a lot about the need for transportation, for meals. And I heard a lot of people here today about speaking the need for in-home services. And this is obviously a great need. I don't care where you are in the United States. because this is one of the ways of keeping people out of expensive institutions like nursing homes at $3,000 or $4,000 a month, you can imagine. And but these are the key things. I think, of course, I am a lot more interested in transportation otherwise too. You know, we let the car become our little angel, you might say, to get us around. You know, and we buried mass transportation many years ago, and it's a shame in this country. Because I've been in other countries and I've seen what a benefit it is over there. And otherwise, I have no basic testimony except I.
There's a need.
God bless you, and we need help, and it's everywhere.
Okay.
And
thank you very much, Carl. Appreciate your coming forward with your testimony today.
Thank you for hearing me, too.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Freeman. I'm with the Oregon Law Center, which is a nonprofit law office representing low-income folks in Oregon. I guess I should say, hi, Representative Strobeck. I'm in your district.
Okay. Glad I stayed.
My written testimony is very short. I'm only here on one very small program within the huge SDSC budget, and that is the TAP program, the Temporary Assistance Program. The two Russian immigrants who testified today, one has applied for the TAP program. The woman is currently a recipient in the TAP program. A few years ago when Congress overhauled the SSI and other welfare programs, they eliminated benefits for many categories of non-citizens. The state stepped in and provided $1.5 million to provide a very small cash grant. It's $275 a month, which is even less than the general assistance grant to these individuals. Currently, there's between 215 and 223 people in this program. Very small program, but for those people in it, it's a huge impact. If this legislature doesn't act, that program is going to expire on June 30th. Some of those people will be on the streets. Some of the people will be moved to nursing home care, which is a lot more expensive than in-home care. And we would urge you to extend the TAP program. If you have any other questions, that concludes my testimony.
Besides the $275 a month, what other assistance are they able to get, if any?
Some of them would qualify for Medicaid. Some of them would qualify for food stamps. It depends on what their immigration status category is and when they entered this country. But that's basically all they have is $275 a month.
Representative Wilson. In coming over here, do they come with the idea that they will receive a place to live or family if their relatives or something onto them?
Well, I can't speak for, I mean, I don't know what their intent is. I know the two people who testified are parolees, which don't confuse that with some sort of a criminal thing.
Oh, no.
It just means that the INS is given. It's within INS's discretion to allow them to be here, but they don't, for example, have refugee status or a status that would entitle them to certain kinds of benefits before they could be deported. But they're here legally and with the blessing of the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
Yes, I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair. That they would be legally here, obviously. I don't know how you'd live on $275 a month. So there has to be some other kind of assistance that these individuals have from federal or state.
Or family.
Or family.
Or something. Because it confused me too, Representative, when you said if this stops, there'll be a rest home. And
well, the one
thing home.
And yes,
I don't understand how could they be transferred to a nursing home? What is keeping them from not being in a nursing home with $275?
They receive in-home services.
For $275?
Their TAP benefit pays for their care to receive in-home services.
and this is only the ones who would otherwise qualify for Medicaid, who get Medicaid now. There's some people who don't qualify for Medicaid. And like I said, it has to do with when you came in and what your immigration status is. But if the in-home service payment stops, then they would have no other choice but to go into nursing home care, the ones who qualify for Medicaid. Those who don't qualify for Medicaid will have nothing. And that may be one explanation for why there's only 215 people in the program right now, is that in most cases they have other families, members or people in the community who can help support them. So these are people who have to meet the other GA financial criteria, which is $50 in cash resources, less than 1,500 total resources, and less than $298 in income. So these are very desperately needy folks.
Okay. Sure, sure. The question for staff, is the TAP program in the governor's budget or the chair's budget?
Madam Chair, Senate Representative Strobeck, no, it is not, in, because it sunsets at the end of this biennium right now. Thank you. Thank you.
I don't think that's a very good answer, because it sunsets at the end of this biennium. It's not in the governor's budget. The governor didn't have any, wouldn't have had any problem with including it and asking for a dismissal of the sunset, it would seem to me, and I just... would feel remiss if I didn't suggest to a few of the folks today, you're down here asking us to do something that the governor hasn't seen fit in his wisdom to do. He's chasing all over the state on education problems and all this kind of stuff with money to burn, and hasn't got time enough to come and put his efforts in on stuff like this, and I think that it sure wouldn't hurt to make touch bases with him and ask him why he's left the programs like this to get into disrepair and total people, and it's something that bothers me tremendously, and I believe me, I'm not against education either, but we have so much tail of money to deal with, and it needs to be put out there in a fair manner to cover the needs that we have in this state, and to be out trying to way, way, way overdue in one particular area when we don't have that money available. Doesn't make any sense from a business or a budgetary standpoint of any kind. We need some help here from another part of the government in order to help us solve some of these problems. And believe me, most of us are dug in tooth, toenail, elbows, and everything else trying to protect these programs and make sure that we get some help out to these folks that come in like that, and the folks that have been here today. And don't just give up after you leave here.
Thank you, Senator. We're actually, I'm trying to get through this list. I have one more panel to go through, and I would just as soon try to get through that panel, and maybe we can touch base with Lori at another time about this program. I apologize. Is it something that you can ask, and she can get the answer to you?
Oh, can I ask, and you can give it to me afterwards? The program is to help them either get SSI or become legal citizens. And how many of the 223 individuals have become legal citizens during the last biennium? You can give me the answer afterwards, if it takes.
I'm sorry, I don't have that, but I could maybe get it from SDSD and then give it to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Finally, I will call up Jim Carlson, Dennis Russell, and Jim Gator. We saved the best for last. No, I didn't mean that.
I'll be very brief, Madam Chair.
You can call me some other time if you
need to. For the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association, Oregon Center for Assisted Living. And I did want to make one point here. With me today is my 7-year-old daughter. You may see her on the back of the hearing room there. And I know you've seen legions of school children this session tracing through the halls advocating for K-12 funding. I wanted you to know, for the record, there's at least one here advocating for adequate human services funding this session.
Excuse me. advocating. Thank you, Jim.
I'm going to just summarize very briefly my prepared remarks. I think you've heard from a broad cross-section of folks today that the governor's recommended budget does not adequately address a host of areas across the continuum of long-term care services and in-home settings for those who can no longer remain in their homes. And we're here to advocate essentially just for a continuing service level. I don't think you've heard anyone here asking for the moon. I think folks are just asking to continue effective core essential safety net programs that are cost effective and that are meeting needs for a very, very vulnerable population. And I want to thank your committee for your hard work and thoughtfulness and attention in addressing this, and particularly, Madam Chair, for all the outreach you have done, getting out and visiting, whether it's disabled children, getting out for the tour the committee took earlier this week, just for the effort and the time you've put into this. Labor costs are driving the cost of delivering services. And there's a chart here in my prepared remarks that a number of charts that I'm going to just try to focus a little attention on, showing that when the minimum wage has gone up by over 25% in the last 24 months in Oregon, it is dramatically driving the cost of delivering the services. Whether you're talking certified nursing assistants in a nursing facility, whether you're talking direct caregivers in community-based care settings, whether you're talking in-home services and programs, the cost of delivering services is going up dramatically, being driven by a tight labor market and low unemployment rates and an escalating minimum wage. The second chart I had here that I wanted to call the committee's attention basically shows on the dark-colored bars that the increase you've seen in the minimum wage, and then this is for community-based care rates, that shows in the 95-97 biennium that there were no COLAs, absolutely no increases approved by the legislature nor recommended from the governor. And then when you get into 97 and 98, you saw just a 3% a year increase. At the same time, the minimum wage went up 10% in 95-97, 9% in 97-98, and another 8% in 98-99. And then you see the governor's recommended budget only recommends a 2% increase for each year of the biennium. Obviously, this picture portrays better than words on how difficult it is for folks to be delivering services and remain competitive in a labor market and to hire and retain caregivers when the growth rate is so slow in this program. I've talked with all of you individually about several of the reduction items in the governor's budget that we are advocating to get restored. Those are cataloged here. I won't get any great detail. The rebasing issues, the community-based care provider wages package piece. I do some comparisons for you on the reimbursement differentials you see in Oregon versus other states. Oregon lags far behind our Northwest neighbors in what they reimburse. I used one example here, which was on the nursing facility rate, where Washington is paying $30 a day more, and they have labor costs that are lower than we have here in Oregon. Even Idaho is $16-$17 a day more with dramatically lower labor costs than we have here in Oregon. It explains why providers in border communities love it when they get clients, even if you're talking to Medicaid clients from Idaho or Washington. It's very good in comparison to the funding levels Oregon has here. The last chart, before I conclude my remarks, that I wanted to show you is that if you look here on the blended average Medicaid cost per case in Oregon between 1993 and the November 98 number on the last DHR rebalance, you've seen an average annual increase of 2.2% a year in the average annual Medicaid cost per case. At the same time, with what we've seen in labor costs and in general inflation, it's very clear that's a pretty flat line. What drives costs in this program area is we've got an aging population, we've got a tremendous need out there, and the line that you see at the top there shows that the aging population is driving caseload and it's basically driving the program costs. And from a provider community perspective, we do not feel that just because one is a provider that they should shoulder an undue burden to bear the cost of the growth of this program. There has to be resources devoted into this, into the delivering the services, and we have to come up with some strategies on how we're going to deal with the growing population. And I just can't miss the opportunity because we have a bill in Representative Strobeck's committee before he sneaks out that will try to focus attention on the future, on trying to incentivize people who do have resources to plan for their future long-term care needs. And I think we need to confront that. As you're aware, there are some additional federal funds that will be available to the state. I'm hoping that this committee will use some of that money to go back into this program to plug some of these holes to get a continuing service level of funding. And I just want to thank all of you for all your hard work and thoughtfulness in your approach on this budget. I do want to mention there's some real quality improvement programs that we work in close partnership with the SDSD and their staff. There were some policy packages there focused on improving quality that were not included in the governor's budget as well. And I just wanted to have you consider that as you're going forward and trying to address challenges in this budget. Thank you.
Madam Chair, quick question. What's the number of the bill in reference to
it? It's House Bill 2080, and it would create a tax credit for individuals or businesses who purchase private long-term care insurance coverage. And we've projected that over the next 30 years, this could have significant Medicaid cost savings for the state for a very modest revenue impact over the same period of time.
Okay. Thank you.
So, thank you very much.
Okay. Jim.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, Great Panthers, Medicare and Medicaid Coalition, and the Alzheimer's Association, as well as my 10-year-old son, Matt Davis, who's also here for Career Day, and will be glad to be another charter member of the Youth Coalition for SDSD. We are here today to express our strong support for Oregon's nationally acclaimed SDSD program, but one that is the continuing level budget as submitted to the Department of Human Resources before the governor's budget came out. We have been very proud of our long-term care, community-based and institutional long-term care program here in Oregon, which has saved millions of dollars for Oregon citizens and enabled us to put that money back into the care of individuals so that we can care for more individuals with the money that we spend here in Oregon. And we are opposed to any cuts to the SDSD continuing level budget, including the cuts in in-home service hours, in-home provider training and pay increases, Oregon Project Independence, provider reimbursement, as Jim was discussing, and the general assistance program. And we would like the budget brought back up to what the continuing level was as submitted to DHR. We feel that the SDSD system has taken its fair share of cuts in the 90s, over $120 million worth of cuts. And although SDSD is a model of cost effectiveness in this country, ranking amongst the lowest in per capita expenditure on long-term care in the country, oftentimes spending half or a third as much as many states, you can only tighten the belt so much until it begins to start to affect our clientele out in the field. Our population, senior population, is growing at a very fast rate, particularly the 85-plus population who will need a higher concentration of these services. So we think that it's a cost-effective system, and we ask you to respond to it by keeping that budget at a level that is appropriate for our clients' needs. I want to mention two other areas that have not been talked about today that I think is very, very important. One of them is senior mental health and alcohol abuse. We would urge the committee to support Senate Bill 880, which will be coming into your committee from the Health and Human Services, which will provide $450,000 to expand coverage for senior mental health and alcohol and drug abuse services here in Oregon by expanding the mental health and alcohol and drug projects through SDSD to expand the amount of money currently being given to the five projects that exist and to create five more projects throughout the state to reach a senior population that is not being served adequately within the mental health and alcohol and drug system. Seniors are faced with significant mental health problems, adjustments, and transitions in their senior years. And national figures are showing 15 to 25% of the senior population suffering some form of mental health problems that need interventions, whether it be depression or sleep disturbances or anxiety. 10 to 15% of the senior population suffer alcohol and drug abuse problems. And the suicide rate among seniors, who represent 13% of the population, is 25 to 30% of all successful suicides. There's a serious problem out there. These projects have done a wonderful job. In the 10 years that they've been in existence, we've received less than $1 million and been able to match that with $2.5 million in private and grant funds and other public funds. And we've reached with this money close to 5,000 senior clients and 5,500 service providers and advocates and family members with training and consultation, as well as the 5,000 we've served with counseling and other services. It's a very cost-effective program, which through our most recent study that we can give you information on has saved the state millions of dollars from the seniors that would have ended up in mental health services or been institutionalized. So we ask for your support for senior mental health and alcohol and drug abuse for seniors. One last thing we'd like to throw in is the use of senior companions. There's also a bill sitting in your committee that's sponsored by our organizations, 695, which would allocate $450,000 of state general fund dollars to the senior companion program to utilize these wonderful volunteers to assist homebound seniors. They are now doing a wonderful job of providing, these are low-income seniors who receive a small stipend to work 20 hours a week with homebound seniors. They assist them in transportation, medical appointments, respite care, personal care. And what we found is the majority of the clients that they reach would be in a nursing home if they didn't have a senior companion coming in and assisting them each week. We'd like to see this kind of support system developed within SDSD. That small investment of $450,000 will create $1.5 million worth of services and put 100 more senior companions out into the field to help these individuals. We would ask your support for this as well. But beyond that, we're asking for strong support for continuing level budget in SDSD. Thanks very much.
One quick question, real quick. It has a few little tails on it, but SDSD 95, the senior companion program. Okay, we've got, help me understand this now. We've got senior companion program, we've got OPI, and then we have some of the people who came up and testified about the people that stay with them. I can't think of the name of that.
CECs, right.
Okay, how do these all dovetail? Are they all totally different programs?
Yeah.
How do they dovetail?
Why don't you combine that to her another time?
Okay. I would make an appointment with you. I would love to talk to you anyway.
I'll bet you do.
So I will have one more gentleman to testify.
Jenna. Madam Chair, committee member. For the record, my name is Ben Russell. Actually, I'm here representing the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, and Sally and Terry are down here quite often, and I think I'll let them talk to you directly. I guess I want to talk from the provider standpoint. I'm the executive director of the Mennonite Home in Albany. Mennonite Home in Albany has 412 seniors in our independent cottages. We have 107 in our assisted living apartments, 95 in our nursing facility, 28 in our special care unit for Alzheimer's and dementia. We have an in-home care program that provides about 7,000 hours a month, and we have a Medicare-certified home health and infusion company. So we actually are providers of every one of the licensures that you've been talking about in Senior Disabled Services Division outside of foster care. That's the only piece that we currently don't have. One of the things I think in the presentation on Monday that was talked about in the discussion around how nursing facility rates are set, we talked about, or what was presented actually, is 88% of the average cost for the facility are reimbursed to the facilities. And I guess I'd just like you to write in your books allowable costs, because a lot of costs that we incur that we deem reasonable based on our mission, based on our not-for-profit status, or based on our commitment to our employees in the community are non-allowable costs. And if we fund a significant percentage of our chaplain hours are disallowed, all the board expenses, we have a community board that governs our facility, and it's a not-for-profit facility connected to the community. And it's important to train and educate our board members, do the board development necessary for them to be effective. Those are considered disallowable costs. Contact therapy, barber and beauty, newsletters, staffing ratios over and above minimum levels, a whole host of things that we do as an organization based on values, based on needs of the client, are considered non-allowable. So when you hear about 88% of the average cost, I think you want to make sure that that's allowable costs, and a significant portion of our costs are disallowed. We actually get about 68% of our costs covered by the Medicaid system. Right now in our nursing facility last year, the losses were $538,000. In our assisted living facility, the losses were $118,000. And we're currently experiencing $38,000 of losses from the Medicaid program in our special care unit for Alzheimer's and dementia. So I think we want to be careful when we talk about our costs being covered and the average cost. Now, we are considered an inefficient provider. That's the term that the division uses for us. Because a number of things that we do, we have 24 paid earned leave days for our staff. We have full medical. We have full dental. We have vision. We have pharmacy. Our starting wage is $757 to $885 for caregivers. October 1 of 1999, it'll be $8 to $945. In addition to all the medical insurance, dental insurance, and earned leave costs, we also pay retirement. So our costs are $994 to $1148 for our caregivers, 10-1 of 1999. It's going to be $10.80 to $12.55. That's what we're paying our caregivers. Now, we're considered an inefficient provider. So our historical costs are not measured. There's an aggregate average. 88% of that is paid. And if we're above that, now, we've made some value-based decisions, and as an organization, we have favorable tax preferences, we have favorable funding sources, so we're not totally insulated from the effects of being a not-for-profit. But the $180,000 annually that we benefit from our tax-exempt status and the community good we do on a dollar for a dollar is not exactly a fair measure of should we continue to be a not-for-profit organization. It really is based on our missions and values. So the moral dilemma that we're put in is, you know, do we stop our transportation services? Do we gouge the private pay and continue to charge them and tax them $19 a day, thus creating a spend down? Do we reduce staff wages and benefits? Do we reduce staffing levels? Do we eliminate training or the use of CNAs? We actually use CNAs in our home care department, in our special care unit for Alzheimer's and dementia, and in our assisted living, even though that's not mandated. Do we reverse the value-based decisions? Do we quit donating a classroom to Lynn Benton Community College? Quality care requires resources. Jim very clearly gave you a graph in his outline that's very, very helpful, in that the costs in the system are caseload-driven costs, not provider payment costs. So I think I would hope that the only thing if I left with you today is that when we squeeze the balloon and we control the continuum and people say, well, in-home care is cheaper than nursing home care, or if this bill doesn't get passed, people are going to end up in a nursing home, because we have the entire continuum, we import services to people in their homes, and we meet with the families and the residents. Sometimes it's cheaper for us to say, well, let's move into the assisted living facility, and they actually get more benefit. But it's still oftentimes at their choice if they have the private resources. If they don't, you know, over half of our residents in those three facilities are Medicaid clients. Sometimes it's cheaper for us to import services to them. Sometimes it's cheaper for them to be in an assisted living facility, the residential care facility, or sometimes the nursing facility. So I also wouldn't want the committee to believe that nursing homes are the highest cost provider. We squeeze the balloon and it pops out somewhere else. In community-based care, we see our residents using physicians, emergency rooms, and readmission rates to hospital more frequently than we do the residents in our nursing center, even though they have a higher acuity level. So when we talk about costs in the system, and maybe it's a good point for a future budget note, at some point we have to track the total cost of caring for these folks, not just worry about our state Medicaid pot of money. Is it costing the Oregon Health Plan more money? An example would be our employees. If they didn't have our package of benefits and wages, would they be getting them from the state somewhere else? If a person's showing up in the ER or in the physician's visit, is Medicare paying that? And is that okay? I think at some point we have to track the total cost of care. So we are very, very supportive about supporting initial funding levels. And I also want to say that the division has been incredibly, it's been a very, very favorable environment to work with senior disabled services. I think the professionalism, they're mission-driven, they have similar advocacy goals that we do in both provider associations, and I didn't want to get into a position of public testimony without saying that. It's actually been a really good partnership and working relationship, and we're very supportive of the current funding levels and are not enamored and not supportive at all of the cuts that are recommended in the governor's budget.
Thank you very much. I appreciate everybody's patience. And the reason there is only one member left is because we are now 45 minutes over our 20 minutes. So I apologize. I should have probably moved people a little bit faster at the beginning, but we were able to get through all of the testimony. I thank you all for being here. And we will give this all very careful consideration. We will, with that, adjourn.
Thank you.